Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places, with your host, Adam Bronstein. Hello, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. In this episode, I am honored to speak with Derek Jensen. Derek is a longtime environmental activist, writer, and philosopher. He has authored dozens of books and essays, and is known in the environmental and conservation movement as one of the great movers and shakers of our time. Derek challenges us to see the bigger picture, question authority, and seek new ways of living with ourselves and the planet. We talk about Derek's background, his history as an activist, the gaps he discovered in the environmental discourse, our cultural hate of nature, the epistemology of science, how we perceive the natural world, reverting to hunter-gatherer societies, the fact that we are an overshoot, the fundamental role of natural communities, the problem with agriculture, the troubles with talk of sustainability without addressing psychopathy and power, the responsibility of participating in the predator-prey relationship, Jevons' paradox, the ridiculous notion that renewable energy will save us, the hypocrisy of the Green New Deal, the collapse of civilization, and living with dignity, moving forward into a terrifying and uncertain future. It was a real pleasure and honor to meet Derek down in the redwoods of Northern California, near his home. It's such a beautiful part of the world, and I'm very fortunate to get the opportunity to visit there every year. This was a really deeply stimulating conversation, and I hope you find it fascinating. Derek has put a lot of thought into the issues we covered, and you can really tell. And I hope that this conversation leads you to explore some of Derek's writing and essays. His books are numerous. It's hard to pick a favorite, but I will say that his collection of interviews with environmental activists and thinkers, it's called Listening to the Land. This is one of my first forays into this sort of material. So I highly recommend picking up that book. You can find Derek online at derekjensen.org, and he has a lot of new books in the works right now, so keep an eye out for some new material to be published in the coming months and years. I do have to apologize. I was testing the outer range of my wireless mic system. Part of the conversation was cut out now and again, but I don't think it interrupted the flow. So if it gets a little bumpy, just hang on. It smooths out again, and yeah, I'll know to keep my receivers a little bit closer next time. I think we had some shielding from our bodies. Hey, one last thing before we jump into the episode. If you're listening via web browser or a link that you found somewhere, I encourage you to X out of that and to go through your favorite podcasting app, whether it's Apple iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, and search on Wilderness Podcast. Look for that green logo with the bear. Subscription is free. You can also gain access to past episodes, and you'll be alerted of new releases.
Well, thanks for meeting me, Derek.
Oh, well, thanks for asking for the interview.
You're very generous with your time with everybody, it seems. So I really appreciate your willingness to sit down with me.
Oh, thanks. Lots of people gave me interviews when I was starting.
Yeah, I've been at this about a year now. With the podcasting side, I've been in doing various conservation work for the past, I don't know, 15 years.
So when did you really
become an activist? Like, what was the catalyst for you?
Well, I became an activist really in 1989, and there were two things going on. One is maybe in 86 or 87, I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas, by which I mean, I'd always known that things are messed up and that, I mean, I've known since I was a kid that this culture is killing the planet, but I didn't know what to do. The problems are so big. And a story I've told a lot having to do with second grade is that they put in a subdivision next to where I lived. And so all the meadowlarks were gone, all the garter snakes. And so even when I was seven, I realized that this can't keep going on, because every time you build somewhere, that's somebody else's home. And if this keeps going on, they'll have nowhere to live. And so I didn't have this language when I was a kid, but I recognized very young that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. the whole thing just seemed completely absurd and horrifying to me. And, you know, in retrospect, I mean, at this point, there are very few people I've ever met who, if they go back to where they grew up, they don't hate it and feel horrified. And, you know, maybe some people from, I don't know, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where it's, you know, actually population is going down. But other than that, wherever you... I was just talking to a guy yesterday or day before who, you know, I grew up in Colorado from 64 to 84. And one of the reasons I had to leave was because there's just too many people. And then this guy moved there in 93 and he had to leave in 03 or something because there was too many people. And so, I mean, there was... The baseline had shifted, but it didn't alter the fact that it was just crazy. And so everybody has these experiences. This is obviously not sustainable, can't last. So I knew that as a kid, and I didn't know what to do. And then in my 20s, you know, I'm just, everything is so big, so I'm not doing anything. I mean, not doing anything for the world. And then I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas. This is something I can do, that for every dollar I spend on gasoline, I can either give a dollar to a local environmental organization, not national, because I knew even then that national organizations aren't very good, and local organizations are always starved for money, or, because I didn't have any money, I could pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. This is something. So at the time, to fill my truck would be $10 in gas. And so if I spend $10 in a week, it means I got to do 2 hours of activism. I didn't give myself any excuses. And so I started doing anti-fur demos, anti-circus demos, anti-war demos, and then I moved from there. The next step came when my mom was going to do some activism, and so she met this guy, John Osborne, who at the time pretty much was what was called the Inland Empire Public Lands Council. It's an organization he founded, and he was a doctor by day and an environmentalist by night, so it's always kind of cracked me up, and I've said this, we're still dear, dear friends. When my mom died last year, he came down to be with us both as she was dying. And anyway, the first memory I ever have of him is my mom said, hey, you should go down and help too. So I showed up late one night, and he was waiting for me on the couch in the office. He was taking a nap, and that was pretty much his life, is he would work in an emergency room, or not, sorry, not an emergency room. He would work as a doctor during the day, and then he would work until 2 o'clock in the morning as an environmentalist, and he'd go to sleep for a few hours. And anyway, so I started helping them with writing, and then after that, I started helping him with timber sale appeals, and just generally, I mean, I became... And another thing about the gasoline thing is that I only did that for a couple months, and then I just stopped keeping track of the activism because I'm having so much fun. So that was my entree. And I understand now that in some ways I was pretty fortunate, because when I used to teach at Eastern Washington University, a lot of my students would say, hey, we want to volunteer, and I would send them over to the Public Lands Council, and then they would come back and complain to me that the Lands Council didn't have anything for them to do. So I talked to the Lands Council about that, and they said, well, here's the problem, is that every new person that comes in, we have to train them to do whatever it is we're training them to do. And most people who come in to volunteer will show up once, so it's not worth our time. So there has to be some way to vet and make sure. I mean, if they're going to stick around and they're going to volunteer 2 hours a week for the next year, of course we'll train them to do something. But there's been so many times that we've put in 6 hours to train somebody how to do a timber sale appeal, and they never show up again. So I don't know how that's changed since then, but I was pretty lucky to have had my mom as the entree, because they knew right away that, I mean, they took me seriously from the beginning as opposed to blowing me off. And had they blown me off, you know, I would have kept trying something, but I wouldn't have had that entree. So that's how I got started.
That's great. I'm just going to check the mic and just make sure we're still going.
I think
we're good, but there's always that chance.
There have been so many times where a recorder works one week, next week we get done with the interview, I go to listen to it and there's nothing. Or I go back and listen to it and there's a terrible echo. So it's crazy, but I have to do three. And then of course there have been times too, this was so bad. There have been times when I would go to meet somebody, I do these now on the phone, but I would go meet somebody, I would drive somewhere, we get done with the interview and I realize I never turned the recorder on. And I'm sure you've done that too, but that.
Yeah.
So that happens, of course. Of course, you're going to check the technology.
Yeah. We're good. It's still rolling. The power is on. It's just, yeah. It's always just kind of lingering. Like, of course. Oh my God, is it working?
And yep.
This it's a Zoom H4. It's been a really reliable unit, but I never fully trust the tech. So
of course,
it's always good. So how's your podcast been going? And I just discovered it maybe 6 months ago or so. There's so much stuff out there, and you know, I really have to be careful with my time and what I'm consuming. But I have been paying attention to your podcast, and I'm very grateful for it.
It's been going okay, I think. I mean, I don't. Are you talking about the videos I put out? Or the videos that somebody puts out for me, or are you talking about the interviews I do?
The Progressive Radio Network interviews, yeah.
You know, I have no idea how many people listen to those, because a couple times I've checked on my on the YouTube channel that somebody puts up for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to do any of that stuff. And, you know, there'll be 1,000 listeners or something, but I think PRN actually has a boatload of listeners when they do it. So, I mean, I have no idea how that is. And I mean, the thing that is true that I like about this is that it's, I've always loved doing interviews because, I'm really fascinated, and this gives me an excuse to talk to the world's experts on vaquitas or the world's expert on king cobras or whatever. And I just find that I don't get paid for the Progressive Radio. If I got paid for it, it'd be fantastic. It'd be like, wow, I'm getting paid to actually learn stuff. You know, that's been the way from the beginning. My two books came out at the same time, and I never know which one was the first one or the second one. But one of my first two books, Listening to Land, was a collection of interviews, and it was, I mean, that's just a form that's really fun and easy for me, and it's so delightful for me. And that
was one of my favorite books ever.
Thanks.
Yeah, that really turned me on to a lot of this stuff, actually. So.
Well, thanks. And it, I did it because I was really, I mean, it struck me that if I want to really learn about claims to virtue, I should talk to the guy who invented the term, and Robert J. Lifton. And I started that book actually almost by accident, because I had done a couple interviews for a book review magazine called the Bloomsbury Review. I interviewed Joseph Campbell, and then later I interviewed Richard Manning, and then I read this fantastic book called The Natural Alien by Neil Everndon, and I'm not normally this forward at all. I'm actually pretty shy, but I wanted to know if he had another book out, so I called his publisher, and they said, actually, he does have one coming out very soon. And I said, great. I was just thinking about buying it, but it's like, for some reason, I said, well, can I interview him? And they said, sure, that'd be great. And then they hooked me up with his department secretary at the university. And she said, he's not here today. Try his home number. I was like, I would never call somebody at home now. But being young and stupid, I called him up and said, hey, will you give me an interview? And he said, you know, yeah, I'm happy to give you an interview. But the thing is, my work is not as important as, say, John Livingston's. And if you're going to talk to me, you should talk to John Livingston. And then he hooked me up with John Livingston. And then I had a couple, and it's like, hey, maybe I should do a few more. And that's where that book started.
It was one of the books in my environmental ethics class in college. And I was never much of a prolific reader. I'm getting better now. And that book, it really turned me on to reading, because it was something I was really interested in, but didn't know that it could be articulated and explored in such a way.
Oh, thanks.
And you know, I'm 36. I'm not particularly old. So this wasn't that long ago. I still feel like I'm just out of college. But your work's been very impactful. And I just got finished reading A Language Older Than Words. That was a great book. I couldn't put that one down.
Well, thanks.
And yeah, it's kind of second what you said, and just your experience with interviewing folks and, you know, doing this podcast, just the chance to sit down and to learn from people has been what's just so important to me. I don't get paid to do this either. I'll get a donation every once in a while through my website, but I'm paying
Right.
I'm paying more than I'm making with just hosting fees and all that, but that's really not...
And driving,
yeah. It's really not where the value is for me. And if I could figure out a way to get paid to do this, I would, but it's, you know, it's sort of beside the point. But just being able to talk with people and to learn from them has been so invaluable to me. And I don't pay attention to the stats of my listeners either. I know it's growing, but I don't really consider that to be my real measure of success. It's I don't even know quite the impact I'm having on the world. And, you know, I want to talk to you about this as well and sort of maybe segue into what it is to be an activist and like what are we doing? Like, we sort of know we're not going to change this culture, but, and we've accepted that, I suppose, but like, why do we keep talking about these things and exploring these things? We must care enough to do it, but yet we sort of are on the Titanic rearranging the deck chairs.
Well, it depends on what you want to save. And if you want to save the Titanic, then yeah. But I don't actually want to save the Titanic. I want to... the metaphor stops here because the Titanic... I mean, it would have been like if the Titanic is going through a huge school of fish and killing all the fish, then I'm interested in saving the fish. It's like John Osborne. I mentioned him earlier, that John Osborne, I ask him why he does this work, and he always says, as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is that if bull trout survive for 10 years, they may still be in 100. But if they're gone in 10 years, they're gone forever. And if these trees are here in 20 years, they may still be here in 100. But if they're gone in 20 years, then this forest in even reasonable geologic terms, not just human terms, is gone forever. That, you know, I mentioned earlier Dick Manning, and I interviewed him about his first book, which was about, he's written more about prairies ever since then, but his first book was about forests. And when I interviewed him, one of the things I said is, God, I just wish we could set aside some land, set aside more land, even if it's been cut over, and then in 500 years we'll have an old growth forest. And he said, Derek, in 500 years, in a forest in the Pacific Northwest, you have not even gone through the carbon cycle once. So that stump right there is, the roots of that stump, or that tree was probably 1,500, 2,000 years old. And it was cut down, let's say, 100 years ago, 80 years ago. And the stump is still there, and that stump is going to take another 300 years to decay. So the carbon in that stump...
A better example is there's this tree here. Let's say this tree is 30 years old, and this tree is 60 years old, just making up numbers. So these can live 2,000 years. So in 500 years, they're not even old yet. They're basically, they're the same age you are. They're 36. They're starting middle age. You know, they're probably... That's in 500 years. And then they have to fall, and then they have to decay.
And this one looks like it got burned up the middle or something.
Yeah, you know, redwood doesn't really burn. It smolders.
Yeah.
So that fire could have been 300 years ago.
Check out that one with all the ivy growing off of it.
Yeah.
We're just, like, in this continual process. And
so the point is that... you know, there are streams through here that have steelhead in them. And as long as those steelhead are still there, there's a chance they'll continue. But as soon as the steelhead are gone, they have to re-inhabit. And if the steelhead are gone everywhere, then they have to re-evolve, which is not going to happen in realistic terms. And so, I mean, all the environmental activists I've known, or back especially when I was doing a lot of the grassroots activism, they're basically just hanging on by their fingernails, waiting for civilization to collapse so that things can start to recover. Because the image I always think about with so many environmentalists is that it's like an emergency room, and there's a patient been brought in, and all the doctors and nurses are frantically suturing wounds, and they're cauterizing blood vessels, and they're stopping the blood flow. I mean, they're stopping the bleeding. The thing they aren't doing, though, is there's a mass murderer who's continuing to stab the patient. And we need to actually stop the patient getting stabbed. That's the primary thing. Which, by the way, I want to also be really clear. I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy, that if people are doing regenerative work on forests, if they're helping forests to either reforest or aforest means that you just let the forest come back on its own, you don't actually go in and plant. If they're afforesting, or if they're reforesting, or if they're stopping trees from being cut, that's all incredibly important work. And that doesn't alter the fact that it's like David Brower said, all of our victories are temporary and all of our losses are permanent. And that's because this culture continues to grind away. And as long as this culture continues to grind away at everything, that's what's going to happen. And so that's where my work has really come in, is I saw a hole in discourse. I saw that everybody, all the environmental activists I knew, pretty much all the activists I knew, were, as I said, just hanging on. They recognize the entire culture is destructive, but they didn't want to take on that big picture. What they wanted to do is protect this 5,000 acres from being cut by this timber sale. They wanted to protect, you know, this group of salmon from being, that stream from being silted in. And so there was a hole in discourse. There were books I wanted to read about, okay, what's the bigger picture? And then also, what are we going to do about it? And nobody else was writing those, so it's like, well, looks like it's up to me. Which is a kind of a funny story about that having nothing to do with me, but having to do with activism, is that there's this sort of activist / comic from the UK. I can't remember his name. I saw him on somebody who showed me his videos maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And he had this big thing about how he kept going to all these activists, when he first became an activist, he kept going to all these activist groups and had these great ideas for what they should do differently. And they would always listen to him, and then they would say, great, why don't you do it? He's like, I don't want to do it. I want to tell you to do it. And it's the same thing. There was a lot of my life has been informed by a conversation I had with Jeanette Armstrong years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago now. Ward Churchill wrote an essay slamming Gerrymander's book In the Absence of the Sacred. And I asked Jeanette what she thought about that, and she said, well, if he didn't like it, he should write his own damn book. And Ward Churchill did write his own damn books, but the point is that if I see something that I don't like, I'm not just going to sit and complain about it. I'm going to try to just do it better. And that's, I think, a really important thing for people to do. That if you... People have written to me from... And this is not true. I'm making up the place. I mean, it could be anywhere. It's like people have written to me from Arkansas or Alabama or Florida or Singapore saying, oh, there's this terrible local environmental thing going on. Can you help with it? And it's like, sounds like you got something to do. Mm-hmm. You know, just roll your sleeves up and do it. And, you know, if you need help connecting to local people, I may or may not be able to help. But it's like, this is your neighborhood, and this is your fight, and time for you to stand up and do it. Because the big distinction is not between those who believe we need to bring it all down and those who don't. And the big distinction is not between those who believe in the necessity of militant resistance or those who don't. The big distinction is between those who get off their butts and those who don't. And, you know, you're doing this, and that's you've gotten off your butt and you're doing something. And that's, you know, a lot of my more militant work, I should say, is based on the notion that there's not very many of us. And so we need to find whatever leverage we can. If there were huge numbers of us, you know, we wouldn't even be having to talk about militant resistance at all, which we can or can't talk about. It doesn't matter to me. The point is that just last night, I got into an argument with somebody who was saying, we're talking about invasive species. And this person was, frankly, pretty ignorant and saying that environmentalists protect invasive species from
those who would try to cull them. And I said, no, that's actually animal rights activists. Environmentalists are generally pretty proactive on, like, wanting to get rid of Burmese pythons in the Everglades. And we can have discussions about whether the animal rights activists or environmentalists are right, whatever. Anyway, but then the guy responded, no, that's not true. Like, take, for example, wolves who are invasive in Idaho and environmentalists want to keep them. I was like, wolves aren't invasive to Idaho. Wolves, they were exterminated in the 30s, but wolves evolved in Idaho. Wolves are part of the natural biome. And that just made me, and I'm sorry to go on about this so long, but it's like, so I was talking to a guy about, I interviewed somebody about Ron Whitaker, who's like the world's experts on king cobras and on snake bites. There's 50,000 humans die every year in India from snake bites. That's a lot. And one of the questions I asked is, so given the 50,000 people are dying every year, do people hate snakes in India? Do you have to fight that battle as you try to educate people? No, not at all. Actually, it's mainly doing things like telling them to wear rubber boots when they go out into the rice paddies at night to do something, because they'll step on a snake and the snake will bite them and they'll die. So it's really just technical education. And the point is that we contrasted that with how much people in the American West hate wolves.
Eradicate.
And, I mean, the hatred of nature is so strong. And, yeah, they got other problems in India. I'm not saying India's perfect, but at least in India they don't hate snakes. And here's my real point, is that even though he lives in India, he knew how much people in the American West hate wolves. And so, I mean, we need to get rid of the entire superstructure that's killing the planet. We also have to help people to fall in love with nature. We have to get them to stop hating nature, because that's a part of it, too. This culture hates nature to its core. Sorry, I'm rambling all over the place.
No, that's great. That's exactly what we're here to do. So, in your book, A Language Without Words, you trace back, you know, some of the significance of our, or maybe some of the reasoning behind our attitudes towards nature, you know, dominating, extracting its wealth. And it really is deeply ingrained in this culture. So how do you change that? I mean, if there really aren't that many activists, which I don't think there are, how do we change? Because we are running out of time. We really are running out of time.
Well, the just one example of how much this culture hates nature is in when I write books, I use the word processing program, and whenever I say the tree who did this or the tree who is standing over there, it tries to correct it to that. And I've had to fight with my publishers, even publishers who have published, you know, 10 of my books before, they still fight me over saying the tree who instead of the tree that, or the river who. And that's how fundamental this is in our being. Or another really good example I like to talk about is Richard Dawkins has this great line about how the way we know that science is true, no, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and predict what will happen and when. And that's true, that we know that science and technology have a fundamentally correct way of looking at the world, because when you get in your car, turn the key, it starts. It works. You flip a switch and the light comes on. If you flip the switch and the light didn't come on, that would mean that their ideas on how to make things work hadn't worked. The problem, and it's true, it's absolutely true, the problem is that we're sitting here right now, and what would happen, don't worry, I'm not going to, what would happen if I reached into my pocket and I pulled out a gun and I pointed this gun at you and I said, and I also held up a hula hoop, and I said, okay, on the count of three, you're going to jump through this hoop, and if you don't, I'm going to shoot you. And so on the count of three, you jump through the hoop. So what do you know? I just made matter and energy. You jump through hoops on command. And I just predicted what would happen to wind. You're going to jump through this hoop in 3 seconds. Either that or you're going to fall to the ground dead. But don't you think that if I did that to you right now, you might not like me? And that might destroy any potential we have for a future relationship. And it's the same, that science and nature, or science and technology, is one way to look at nature, and it's one way to look at the world. And, but Richard Dawkins perfectly articulated a way of perceiving the world. Epistemology is how we know something is true. And central to the epistemology of science is this making matter and energy jump through on command. But again, that's only one way. That's a way of looking at the world that is perceived on, that is based on perceiving these others as matter and energy, as opposed to personality. And that's not to say, this is one of the things that pisses me off. There's a lot of critiques of science that I think are really stupid, and I don't think mine is. Otherwise, I wouldn't make it. But the there are a lot of critiques that say that, that argue that, like, the facts that we get from science are not accurate. And that's just nonsense. I mean, if we cut down this tree, it, well, it's a bad example with a redwood tree because they can come back up from burls and from the roots. But if you cut down a Doug fir, it will, that'll kill it. And we can, using methods of science, predict, we have figured out, like, the...
You cut the next Doug fir, that's not coming up either, right?
Yeah, and we know why and how it's going to die, because you have eliminated the capacity of the roots to send of nutrients to be able to move from the roots up to the crown. And so there are... Have you ever had a surgery?
Have you ever had a surgery?
Any surgery.
Yeah, I had a hernia.
Okay, so... They knocked you out?
Yes, they did.
Okay, so they had to... They used the methods of science in order to figure out how to anesthetize you such that you don't wake up screaming halfway through the thing.
They want that repeatable.
Yeah, they want that repeatable. And that's very powerful. The thing is, it's...
Although some people do wake up.
I've heard about that.
And they remember.
Which sounds very dreadful.
Yes.
And I don't want to think about that too much because I have had some surgeries and I've just the thought of...
Yeah.
And plus, they also have given you I don't know if they did it for that. You were all the way under?
I was.
Yeah, so they gave you also a, what's the word? Something that will paralyze you. I don't know what the word for that is right now. A paralyzing agent, which is why they have to put you on a ventilator. Because they also don't want you, they don't want your muscles, they don't want things like you having... what's it called?
A spasm or something.
Yeah.
So you injure it further.
Yeah. So, yes, we want all that to work, which doesn't alter the fact that we should understand some of the underlying, a great line by Robert Coombs, I believe his name is, he said, unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. And so I think it's really important to look at the premises that underlie. And so science is a really, really, really powerful way of looking at the world in terms of if you want to make matter and energy jump through some command, or when you're under surgery, you want them not to jump through hoops. You don't want them not to jump at all. And that's really an important... No, it's a really powerful way of looking at the world. But again, what's lost in that? And so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And one of the things they've said to me about that is that one of the central differences between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most progressive Westerners... or open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. And another way to say this is that we in the West generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And that's really important because how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. And if you perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, then that's how you're going to treat the world. And if you perceive the world as consisting of other beings to enter a relationship with, then that's what you'll do too. And a great example of this is we went out to the ocean a little while ago before we settled on this place to do the interview. And this is a fishing and crabbing town, tourism mainly now since the fishing has kind of collapsed. But when the crabbers go out, there was this article in the paper several years ago that said the reason the crabbers will work so hard is because at that point every crab was worth $1.50. And they said, just imagine there's all these envelopes filled with $1.50 in cash all over the ground. You'd run around picking those up as fast as you can, right? And that's true. If there was a bunch of envelopes here, we would both be picking them up, probably, presumably. But that's the thing, is that crabs aren't actually envelopes filled with $1.50. They are other beings whose lives are as important to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. And they are beings who have important roles to play in their natural community. And I'm not saying you can never eat a crab, which we can get into if you want. But what I'm saying is that they're not an envelope full of $1.50.
But they are according to our culture.
According to the culture. And that's one of the reasons this culture is killing the planet.
Yeah.
And I would also point out that we are sitting right here on Talawa land. And I'm not saying the Talawa are perfect. I'm not saying any indigenous people are perfect. There's no such thing as perfection. The thing that's perfection is the same sort of Christian notion of this perfect heaven thing. But the point is that the Talawa lived here for 12,500 years, at least. I mean, they got them carbon dated to 12,500 years. And when the Europeans arrived here, the place was a paradise. I mean, the salmon were on the Klamath just south of here were black and the Klamath was black and roiling with fish. And they've recently had to shut down their Klamath, their salmon festivals, because they don't have enough fish. And that's crazy. We've only been here, this culture's only been here for 170 years or something.
I know. It's just, I mean, case after case after case after case. It's like,
yeah, it doesn't
when
matter
do we wake
are.
Up? When do we wake up?
Well, that's the question. And I think, honestly, most people don't, ever.
Now we have fish hatcheries to supplement, or we're always compensating and trying to, but it's the same mindset of consumption that's gotten us here in the first place. And we can't recreate wild nature. We have to let it be. But right. How else do we survive in this culture? As you've alluded to in many different cases, like, we can't go back to be hunters and gatherers because we've lost that generational knowledge of how to do so.
We will. That's the only way it's sustainable. So we'll either be living that way or we won't be living at all.
As we kill off indigenous cultures and westernize them, we lose the ability to learn. But we've also, I mean, we can get into how we're all just mostly oil-based creatures anyways at this point.
Right.
We're long past overshoot, but...
Right. So here's the thing.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. And there's a conversation I had with George Drafin back in the 90s, where we're stuck in traffic in Seattle, and I'm making conversation. I say, so George, if you could level any level of technology, what would it be? I'm just shooting the breeze. And he says, he was in a terrible mood. He said, Derek, that's a stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but there's only one level of technology, it's sustainable. And we'll be living there again someday, and the only question is what's left of the world when we get there. And so we will be hunter-gatherers again someday, or we won't survive at all, because it's the only way of life that's ever been sustainable. And every cell in my body wishes that we would have a voluntary transformation where we go, hey, you know, here, all of my work is based on one sentence, I think, which is, this way of living is not sustainable, semicolon. When it's over, I would prefer there is more of the world left rather than less. That's it. That's all my work in one or two sentences. And every cell in my body wants for that to be voluntary, but it's not happening, which means that's where we move toward, in my perspective, militants, because the world is more important to me than this culture. The world is more important to me than my life. The world is more important to me than anybody's life, except the world's life.
Oh, entropy.
Yeah, he's out of the forest just saying.
You've got a couple needles in your hair there. That's good.
So for the listeners, as I said that, a small branch just fell out of a tree and hit me in the head.
At least it wasn't a big one.
So was it
a good omen? There's some big ones up there.
Well, is it a good omen, or is it like telling me cut that shit out?
I don't know. Maybe don't think about it too much.
Or maybe it was patting me on the head.
Could have been.
Hey, we like it.
Could have been.
Or perhaps it was just matter and energy falling through. It was pure random. What was I saying? Oh, so, you know, you talked about overshoot, and I mean, here's one of the things that kills me. One of the reasons I know we're not going to have a voluntary transformation is we can't even talk about the fact that we're an overshoot. If you talk about the fact that we're an overshoot, there's too many people on the planet, there's too much consumption, and so people immediately go, why do you hate babies? Why do you hate humans? I was like, no, actually, I'm just talking about physical reality. And so we can't even have intelligent discussions. If we had intelligent discussions about it, we could actually solve overpopulation really easily. It's very simple. Half of the children born today are not actively wanted, which means give women absolute reproductive freedom. Problem solved. Except two things. One is the Abrahamic religions that, you know, men controlling women's reproductive rights. And second, capitalism's growth imperative. And just a couple days ago, I was seeing this argument too. Somebody was saying that the optimal birth rate, that they were saying the birth rate in China and Russia is too low. And this is one reason I know that all of our discussions about population are kind of crap, because when they talk about population, what they're mainly saying is people in poor countries have to have fewer children. I think all humans, I mean, there's too many humans on the planet. That's just, anybody who disagrees with that's an idiot.
Even if, like, our rate of consumption is 10 times higher than somewhere else.
They're both true.
There's still just too many of us.
There's too many of us, and there's too many of us driving cars. I'm driving a car, too.
Yeah.
It's both. I don't understand why both can't be true.
And everyone wants that, the Western lifestyle, or at least it gets forced upon them, and then they're caught up in it, and then they have to...
If you have a choice, if your choice is not to live in a functioning community with plentiful salmon, if that's not your choice, but your choice is to live within the system where you have to pay a landlord for your rent every month, and you have to, wouldn't you rather have more than less? I mean, if you're going to be in a prison anyway, I'd rather be a trustee than somebody who's in the bottom of that pile. And, the reason I know it's all crap is because when they say, we need to stop population growth, they say that, and then 10 minutes later, they can complain because Japan and Russia, the people are not having enough children, and so they give them sex holidays to go home and have sex and hopefully have babies. And that lets me know that all this discussion is bogus.
Yeah.
Because there's this capitalist growth imperative that...
There's a stigma about not having kids, too, I feel like. Because I get asked all the time, and my wife does too, like, you know, do you have kids? I say, no, we don't. Oh, so... when are you going to have them? Or, you know, it's like there isn't a choice, or it's like, right. Oh, so you're putting it off or whatnot. And, you know, there's that biological urge, and my wife feels that more than I do. And it's tough because as a species, I mean, we're programmed to keep going, and there's that.
I don't disagree. Except if you limit their food supply, worms will limit the number of babies they have.
Right.
And that's not true. It's just worms. It's true of many species.
Yeah.
Not all of them. When they talk about the bacteria in a petri dish, I mean, sometimes, but that's not actually true for all species.
And I forget who talks about this specifically in their work, but when you keep expanding the food supply and the human food supply, then the populations keep exploding.
It's when they all the discussion of food supply and populations backwards. Population follows food supply, and I mean, people are not fundamentally stupid. And part of the problem, too, I mean, here's the problem that has gone back to the beginnings of this culture, is that what agriculture is clearing the land of every other species and devoting it all to human food production. That's what it is. I mean, if we were going to convert this to a wheat field, we'd cut down all the trees, we'd plow it up, that's killing it all the way down to the bacteria, planting wheat, and then making bread. The advantage is that you can provide more food for humans. A few disadvantages. One of them is that you have converted all of this, I hate the word productivity, but we're going to use it, You've converted all this productivity to human use, as opposed to redwood use, flying squirrel use, salamander use, salmon use, and human use. You know, you've converted all of that. I love the line by John Livingston, there is no surplus in nature.
Yeah, I love that one too.
That doesn't mean you can't eat salmon or crab or huckleberries. It doesn't mean you can't eat those. It's just that anything you eat means somebody else doesn't eat it.
Right. You're taking it. And, yeah, sustainability is sort of a funny thing. But anytime you're removing something, you're taking it. And it's gone it can't be recycled as nutrients back into that system, or something else can eat it.
Well, it can be recycled back as nutrients, which is the whole point with salmon. Salmon swim up the river, and then bears eat them, humans eat them, eagles eat them.
If humans eat it,
and then
it's taking it out of that forest.
Well, it depends. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. If you eat it and then you poop somewhere else, that's exactly what you're doing. But mm-hmm. if you eat it, you walk 200 yards and you poop in the forest, that's actually what's supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's what bears do. That's one of our roles. And that's one of... And then, anyway, but yes, any salmon I eat is a salmon that can't be eaten by a bear. And, oh, so back to agriculture means you're converting the entire place to human use. So the advantage is there's more food for humans. Disadvantage, everybody else dies. Too bad for them, I guess, huh? And then the other disadvantage is that you will degrade the land because the redwoods, the salmon, the Doug firs, the bears, they're all... This is a fundamental mistake that our culture makes that I am just astounded that 99% of the people in this culture don't get, which is the fundamental role of any being in your natural community, which is the word I use instead of ecosystems usually, but I'll sometimes forget and use ecosystem, so just interchangeable if you hear me say both. The fundamental role of any being in a natural community is to make that natural community more healthy on its own terms. And that's how how do people think that these forests got to be so rich in the first place? How do they think that the prairies got to be so deep with soil? They did it because buffalo worked with prairie dogs, worked with badgers, worked with grasses, mm-hmm. all to make soil and all to improve the health. And that's what happens over time, because if you are only harming the land a little bit, and say you harm it 0.1% every year, that means in 1,000 years you've destroyed it completely. And so you can't destroy it 0.1% every year and live there as the Tallawa did here for 12,500 years. You have to actually be, and something that blows me away, this is a total sideline, but I recently learned, or several years ago, I learned that the population in this county was huge. Okay, there's maybe, I don't know what the population is now, let's say 30,000. There were probably like 12,000 to 15,000 Indians living here in this county because it was so rich with salmon.
Yeah.
It's like the population hasn't even increased that much because of all the stuff we do. There are places, like places on the Great Plains where before horses their population was really sparse, or places in Nevada, some of the desert areas where the human population is pretty sparse. But man, this place was packed.
Yeah.
And it could support
those people.
It did support it for 12,000 years. Anyway, so when you have agriculture, one of the disadvantages is that you're going to destroy your land base. You might be able to support that many more humans for a while.
You're front loading, essentially, right?
Exactly.
You're taking everything now and then screw the future generations.
Exactly.
We're no more longer sustainable.
Exactly.
It's an extension of neoliberal economics, I suppose.
Exactly. So what that means is in a couple generations, a couple years, however long it takes, 100 years, doesn't matter, you're going to have a choice. You can either collapse or you can conquer a new place.
Right.
And the problem for the entire planet, there's a line that John Livingston said that when he said it, I kind of disagreed with him, but I've come to agree more. That he said that the problem with humans was when we substituted ideology for instinct. And I didn't like that at first, but I understand it now. And the reason I understand it, I don't know if this is what he meant, but this is what I got out of it, is that ideology is not as reliable as instinct, in that you can have an ideology that will allow you to live in a place for 12,000 years. You can also have an ideology that will allow you to destroy the place. So it's not reliable. So I wish that I, he's long dead, but I wish that I could go back 25 years later and interview him again and say, so you said this, and I disagreed, but now, is this what you're saying with it? Because maybe it means something else entirely. Anyway, so the problem is that once you've destroyed your land through agriculture, you have a choice of collapsing or expanding. And the problem is that by converting the land base into humans, you've been able to create an army. And you've also been able to create weapons of war, converting the trees into chariots or into the forests of North Africa. North Africa was heavily forested prior to this culture. They converted those. I mean, you look at Libya and Tunisia.
Cedars of Lebanon and all
that.
Well,
Cedars of Lebanon, yeah. And those, North Africa was converted to Egyptian and Phoenician navies, which allowed them to expand. So you have a competitive advantage over your neighbors, which Indians complained about all the way across the continent. It's like, you know, we won this battle. So what? They just assembled a bigger army and they're coming back next week. And this is, which is David Brower's lament too, that every loss is temporary, every victory is temporary, every loss is permanent. And so the problem is that agriculture, moving forward now to the science and technology where you're making matter and energy and through hoops on command, that gives you a competitive advantage over everybody else. And if they don't want you... So I did this conference back in 97 or so. And it wasn't a conference. It was a workshop. It was like 20 of us, 30 of us were doing this facilitated thing. And toward the end of it, they had this exercise where we're all supposed to pretend it's 20 years later, which has come and gone, and we were now living sustainably. For the record, I just gave him a wry/dirty look over the fact that we were supposed to be living sustainably 20 years later in 1997. And everybody, and the exercise was to describe what this would smell like, what our community would feel like, what would happen. And we all closed our eyes. Well, everybody but me closed our eyes. I was cheating. So everybody else was closing their eyes. I looked around. Everybody else is smiling, just so happy to think about this sustainable community. And they went around the group describing it and saying, oh, we bike to work. We go on bike paths. Everybody is, you know, they enjoy their jobs and they, you know, I don't know what. And we smell the beautiful trees in bloom. And they got to me and I said, I'm sorry, I just have a really hard time with this because, first, we didn't talk about how we got from here to there. And in order to get from here to there, we have to deal with the psychopaths in power, and we have to deal with the fact they're killing everything. Next, people talked about riding bikes. Where do you get the metal for the bikes? I mean, the metals require mines, and mines are not sustainable, will never be sustainable. No mine has ever been sustainable. And third, if we in our community are able to live this way and those in power discover oil under our land, we all know what happens to us in our sustainable community. We get killed. I mean, we get kicked off our land and those of us who resist get killed. And so this whole discussion is, I find, very troubling. And I think about that quite often because I once did a talk at Bioneers. It's a bunch of people. It's a big conference. It happens many places around the country. Excuse me. And they're very positive. And it's like one of their slogans one year was "The shift is hitting the fan."
Oh, and okay. It's hopium.
Hopium. And
the shift is hitting the fan.
Yeah, it was pretty clever.
Yeah.
But clever is what it is, and it's not real.
Greenwashing.
Yeah, so I was on this little panel, and then one of the things I said was, something that breaks my heart is that, you know, I've listened to some other talks, and nobody here is talking about either psychopathology or power. And you can't talk about the murder of the planet without talking about psychopathology. And you can't talk about social change without talking about power. And those things desperately need to be part of the conversation. So why are we doing this as activists? You know, getting back to that question a long time ago. I mean, my big thing is my loyalty.
There are those... your loyalty lies with the natural world above all, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you... I like to tell people that I like humans, but I don't like humanity. And,
yeah,
you know, at least in our present iteration, or I don't know, but like, how do you reconcile all that? Like, how do you form relationships and bonds with people? And at the same time, you know, your loyalties are with the natural world.
I don't take it personally. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I have friends. I don't beat myself up because I eat. There was a guy once, I got in a big argument with this guy 20 years ago, 18 years ago. He was saying, because you use toilet paper, you are just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser. And I didn't have an answer for that at first. It just seemed absurd to me, but clearly not true. But how do I... And then one day I was walking through the forest, and I really mean this when I say the tree said. I mean the tree said. I'm still trying to figure out the branch thing. But I was walking through a forest, and I asked a tree. I know exactly what tree it was. The tree has since been, the top half has been killed by bears. They girdled it. It's a beautiful, beautiful big Doug fir. Anyway, I was walking by the tree. Huh, it's interesting that was a tree that got killed by them. Interesting, maybe. Anyway, and I said, so what's the deal with this? And I immediately got an answer, which is, look, you're an animal. You consume things. Get over it. And second, here's the deal. The problem is not that you consume things. The problem is that you consume things without participating in the fundamental predator-prey relationship. And the predator-prey relationship is, if you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. Responsibility comes from the respondere, which means to give in return. I love this. So everybody knows that if the mergansers eat all of the newts in the pond, they won't be able to eat them next year. And if they don't know that, guess what? Those mergansers are going to die out because they're not going to be able to eat next year. And one of the reasons that the Talawa could live here for 12,500 years is because when they would consume the flesh of the salmon, they know they are now responsible for the continuation of the other's community. And this is not a human thing only, that humans are the only ones who can take responsibility. This is everybody. This is how nature works. And if when it doesn't work that way, you die out.
I mean, like trees exchanging nutrients, that sort of deal.
There's that, and then there's also... I mean, non-humans can fall into this too. When you have an invasive species, you know, Burmese pythons or something, who some species who doesn't have anybody to keep them in check, if they overshoot their carrying capacity, or if you have too many deer on an island, what happens? It collapses. So when I talk about nature being based on cooperation, when I talk about us taking responsibility for the continuation of the community, this is not necessarily just all woo-woo and, oh, it's special and the tree speaks to me and I have, you know, it's this wonderful thing. No, it's if you don't follow this, you die. You know, you die out as a community. You die out as a species. And
as can be observed now through our collective trauma.
Yeah, and there's...
And our fight to get every last resource in ourselves as we slowly right. slip into authoritarianism around the world. And
that's not so slow. But yes, I agree. I completely agree. And so the point is that when I use toilet paper, yes, I am culpable for deforestation, but not because I use toilet paper. Instead, because I use toilet paper... and don't stop Weyerhaeuser from deforesting. There's so much... See, here's a really important thing, is that in the 80s was the first time that corporate newspapers called human beings consumers more often than it called them citizens. And that's really important when people say you're culpable because you consume toilet paper. That's limiting my ways of resistance to consume and not consume. It's very neoliberal. It's very individualistic. If I'm a citizen, I can boycott, I can petition, I can organize, I can, when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, can any system be more destructive of life than killing the planet? It is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. We can revolt. That is what a citizen can do. A consumer can't do any of that. So for us to change our identification to consumers from citizens is a tremendous narrowing of our options. And the same thing happened several years ago when we went through entered sort of Max Weber's social compact, where we agreed that the state would take care of us. That's where we forgot that we are human animals with teeth and claws who require habitat to survive. We said, oh, the state will take care of all that and take care of us. And we need to move those processes. We need to rebirth. We need to go back through those processes to remember that we're not just consumers. We are citizens. And then we're not just citizens, but we're animals who need habitat.
That's why I love the wilderness idea so much today, even though it's in some ways disrespectful to Native American communities because they never saw themselves as being apart from nature to begin with. So how can you have this wilderness? But, I think that it's...
We're where we are.
We're where we are, exactly. So, it's a matter of looking at the world realistically and saying this is where we are, and we have these islands of habitat. And, I'm excited to be talking to you about all this stuff because... what we do in the quote-unquote front country really impacts what happens in the back country. And there's only, 3% of our land base now is right. Designated wilderness. And this is the best way to protect biodiversity that we have from a land management standpoint. What we do with our consumption and the way we see ourselves as citizens or consumers or the way we move forward is going to have a big impact on our last shots at protecting biodiversity and in our wild places. And the sooner we can get our act together, the more we'll leave left for future generations, if there are any.
Well, again, I want for us to have a voluntary transformation where tomorrow, and I like sports. I mean, I'm not one of those people who like wants to get rid of football because I want to get rid of football. But I think retractable stadium roofs. If I were president, if I were dictator tomorrow, I wouldn't deindustrialize immediately. I wouldn't like say, okay, everybody on a ventilator, you're dead. I would start by getting rid of golf courses, getting rid of all irrigated alfalfa. It's like just start with the low hanging fruit. There's so much low hanging fruit that we could get rid of tomorrow, and then the next day, you take out something that hurts a little bit, and then the day after that you take out something that hurts a little bit more, or at least the month after, whatever. And I mean, there are so many,
you'd have to have willing subjects, right?
Oh, I'd be dead.
You'd be dead in 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. people talk about, oh, we're having something, this shift is hitting the fan. It's like, for God's sake, there is so much electricity goes into server farms. That didn't happen. I mean, they didn't exist 30 years ago. The demand is going up everywhere.
There's cryptocurrencies now,
cryptocurrency
too, and all of our data is on the cloud.
And I'm writing a book right now about how marijuana legalization has been primarily a transfer of wealth from family farmers, Northern California, for God's sake, from family farmers to entrepreneurs and rich people.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, it's like, oh, my God. Since marijuana got legalized in Colorado, I don't remember the numbers exactly, but it's like, okay, I'm making this up, but people, as long as I can now make up anything I want, as long as people know I'm making it up, it's like, it's now the fourth biggest use of electricity in Colorado or something. It's incredible how much electricity, which wasn't there 30 years ago, it's just
What's that? Is that Jevons paradox? Is that when you create?
Oh, should we talk about Jevons paradox? Yeah. See, okay, so I got a book coming out in a year with Max Wilbert and Lear Keith.
So the Breakery and Lies.
Yeah. And that book's fundamentally how, you know, we're told that wind and solar are going to save the planet. Well, the wind and solar can't even save the economy. I mean, they're not helpful for the planet. They're actually quite destructive on many levels. And then also something people need to understand when they think about, and also the economy can't run. Oil is incredibly useful for the system because it's mobile. You know, you can put it in a tank and run it, and it's incredibly energy, what's the word? It has a high energy capacity that if you take a semi, has 60,000 pound payload, you can run it 600 miles on a load of diesel. Run that same semi, in order to have batteries to run it 600 miles, you have to have 55,000 pounds of batteries to run 60,000 pounds, which means you have a 5,000 pound payload. What's the point?
Or look at conventional oil versus fracking, right? So it used to be, what was it, like 100 to 1 EROI?
Yep.
And now it's 4 to 1. And
solar and all those aren't even 1 to 1, or they're barely 1 to 1.
Right.
And there's no point except to get subsidies.
Right.
And then, in addition, there's something that they all ignore, which is called Jevons paradox. Jevons was a economist in the 19th century who discovered that he studied coal. And he studied how if you increase the efficiency in coal use, you would think that would decrease the amount of coal that you can use. Because if now if we can cook our dinner or we can heat our house with half as much coal because the stove's twice as
efficient,
thank you, coal use should cut in half. But it's not true.
A bigger house.
Exactly. You build a bigger house. You find more uses for it. And a way to think about that is, let's go back to marijuana. Let's say you got an indoor grow, which, again, in Northern California, you can hear people talk in the grocery store. Even when it was illegal, it cracked me up. It's illegal here, but you see billboards for turkey bags, because turkey bags, they contain the scent, and they hold about a pound. So I've never lived in a place before where you see billboards advertising turkey bags. I mean, it's everywhere. At one point, one out of every five houses in Arcata was a grow house. So the point is, marijuana is just, everybody knows it. So the point having to do with this is, let's say you have a grow, and let's say electricity is your primary cost, and your electric bill is $1,000 a month for your growing.
Your sodium lights, your really powerful energy hog lights.
Yeah, and you are making, let's say it's $1,000 a month for that. I'm just making numbers up. $1,000 a month for labor, and you sell it for $4,000, so you're making $2,000 a month. It's a decent living, $24,000 a year, as long as you're not don't have kids. But now they can cut your electricity price in half, so you have a choice. You can either now make $2,500 a month, which brings you up to $30,000 a year. Or what if I double the size of my grow?
Labor's and install not gonna LED lights, which are much more efficient, too.
And well, or I could triple the size of my grow.
Energy's cheaper, and the equipment's more efficient.
And this way, now I have to buy more fertilizer. I have to buy more soil. I have to buy more plastic bags. I have to buy more turkey bags.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that because energy got cheaper, I actually expand its use. And that's Jevons' paradox. And so the real point is that all this stuff with wind and solar is crap on so many levels. And one of the levels at which it's crap, I mean, the most important level at which it's crap, is the world does not need more electricity. The world does not need more industrially generated electricity. Of course, it needs electricity because that's how your nerves' impulses travel. But it doesn't need industrially generated electricity. That does not help sea turtles. It does not help desert tortoises. It does not help little brown bats. Which, for me, is always the measure. It makes it so you can mine more Bitcoin, and it makes it so you can grow more marijuana, and it makes it so you can run more ventilators. I'm not going to just make it so it's all extravagant stuff. But it runs the economy. And the real point is that every time they have added on a new source of energy for this culture, the old source has not gone down. So when they added oil, wood use did not go down. Wood use increased. When they added hydro, oil use did not go down. It increased. when they added nuclear. I got in a big fight with somebody about this a few months ago who was arguing that when they put in nuclear in France, it decreased fossil fuel use. No. It decreased percentage of total energy use provided by fossil fuel, but because between 1964 and 2016, or whenever the numbers were that I was using, total energy use went up, actual fossil fuel use went up. Just percentage of total energy use provided by fossil fuel use went down. So nuclear did not help get rid of fossil fuels at all. This whole thing is a big scam.
Also, the electricity we're generating, we're just talking about electricity here, right? And that's only
20%.
Yeah, I was going to say 20-25% of our total energy consumption portfolio.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to get really mad. I'm already really mad. I want to rant, is what I want to do. That you'll see the Sierra Club, a bunch of cities all over the world, Munich, Los Angeles, all these cities say we're going to 100% renewable energy. Can I swear?
Yeah.
Bullshit. Bull fucking shit. That's a lie. That's a goddamn lie. No. They're going to... Well, first off, what do they define as renewable? Renewable includes wind, solar, which are problematical. It includes hydro, which is terrible. And it includes biomass. The biggest... By actual amount of energy used, the biggest contributor to, quote, renewable energy the whole European Union is biomass.
Yeah, from southeast forests, and they're just shipping, they're getting cut here, they're getting shipped over there, pelletized.
And biomass is a fancy word for cutting down forests.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it must be admitted, also for growing crops that you burn, like ethanol. So biomass is those two things. So this is not... That's not helpful.
It's all greenwashing.
And the way they count biomass as carbon neutral, if my loyalty wasn't to the natural world, I would think this is funny. As it is, I think this is obscene. They say, okay, because those trees sequestered the carbon before, and now we're cutting them down, this is all carbon neutral. That's like saying, do you have a bank account?
Yeah.
Okay, that's like saying, because you
it's
put money
low.
We'll put more in and then I'll take it out and we'll call this bank account neutral. Because you put it in and I take it out, who cares? And also they say that this is carbon neutral because over 100 years, the forest might regrow and recapture that carbon. Can you imagine any accounting firm in the world that would not be, the accountants would be put in prison if they said our books are balanced because we spent money this year and we're going to get it back in 100 years. And that excludes, by the way, the fact that if we don't cut any of these trees here, and don't worry, trees, we're not going to cut you down. If we were to cut these trees here, no, if we don't cut these trees, they will continue to sequester carbon over time. And in fact, as trees individually and as forests collectively get older, they sequester more carbon every year. The rate of carbon sequestration goes up. So when they say the cutting down a forest, burning it, and expecting it to regrow again over the next 100 years is carbon neutral.
Assuming that land even stays in forests.
Yeah.
Land use, right?
And that's,
we leave it, don't develop it. And that's making a pretty gross assumption.
And in addition, that's presuming that a tree plantation is the same as a forest, which is not true.
Monoculture.
So there's all those things, but there was somewhere else I was going to go with this. Where before we jumped, biomass. So 20%, we're going to go with that number. So first off, a lot of the renewables are bullshit. I mean, they're not sustainable. They're not good for the natural world.
Yeah.
But in addition, they're just lying because they say we're going. And one of the presidential candidates, I think it might be Bloomberg, was saying that we're going to go to 100% renewable energy. It's like, you know what? You should not be president because you don't know the difference between energy and electricity. Now, I'm not expecting that the next time I go to the grocery store, the clerk has to know the difference between energy and electricity. I don't care. And even though I have a degree in physics, you know, 20 years ago, I would have known the difference between energy and electricity, but I wouldn't have known the 20% number. I wouldn't have cared. And, you know, back when my mom was alive, if she and I were having a casual conversation and she says, oh, we got the energy bill today, and it's actually the electric bill, I'm not going to be a pedant and yell at her.
But the thing is, these people are discussing public policy, mm-hmm. which means they should know the difference between energy and electricity. Energy, as you said, is 20% of total electric. See? I just made the mistake. But that's the thing. Electricity is 20% of total energy use. So when they say LA is going 100%
renewable, they're going 20% renewable.
And
that's not even really renewable because of all the energy going in to build the panels and extract the resources and all this. So
the whole thing is about subsidies for wind and energy companies.
Yeah,
that's the whole point.
The Green New Deal is capitalism 3.0 or whoever you want to demarcate.
Yeah, there's two things that are really central to this. One of them is it is just subsidies. They want subsidies for their pals. It's two sectors of capitalism fighting, the oil industry and the wind and solar industry. But they're not even really fighting because the whole climate change movement, as it's manifesting with its calls for massive subsidies for wind and solar, is really, I think, a response to upcoming peak oil or ongoing peak oil. That those in the oil companies, they understand that the oil's not, I mean, that the EROI on the oil they're getting now is not what it used to be. And they will have to devote, and there's ever-increasing energy demand. And so
you could say we haven't had real economic growth in this country since the 70s, right? It's all based on debt.
Right.
And it's all a big facade. So how do they keep it going? I don't know.
Like, well, one way you can keep it going is by throwing a whole bunch of subsidies, making a Green New Deal, mm-hmm. literally a Green New Deal, where you take a whole bunch of public money and you use it to build all of these wind and solar harvesting. By the way, I don't use energy generation because they're not really generating energy. They're harvesting energy. And we need to recognize that there is no surplus in nature. And when you harvest energy, even from the wind, I know people are going to laugh at me for this, but this is noticeable. When you harvest energy from the wind, it comes from somewhere, and that wind was useful. And they have found that areas downwind of wind harvesting facilities have lower wind speeds. And they have also, it changes rain patterns. It already does that. And in fact, Mark Jacobson has talked about using wind energy offshore to decrease the strength of hurricanes, which from an industrial perspective, like, sure, I don't care. We can make matter and energy jump through hoops on command all we want. But hurricanes actually serve really important purposes of moving
nutrients
all over. It helps to, there are times when forests need to be broken up. I mean, that's just part of the natural process.
I heard that.
Yeah.
We actually have time to get out of the way, so we might as well look up for a second.
Yeah.
Okay, we're good.
I mean, like forest fires, it's a natural churner.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the image that strikes me with this culture all the time is, did you ever see that the Sorcerer's Apprentice? It's in Fantasia. It's an animated feature by Disney.
Yeah, it was a really long time ago.
Yeah, and the Sorcerer's Apprentice is about Mickey Mouse becomes this apprentice to the sorcerer. It's based on a poem by Faust, and it's weird because I frankly think the cartoon's better than the poem, which is weird because, I mean, not by Faust, by Goethe, who also wrote Faust. Anyway, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, he's the apprentice to the sorcerer, Mickey Mouse is, and the apprentice leaves for the day and tells him not to get in any trouble. But he uses what little powers he has to, he doesn't want to sweep up the floor, and so he animates brooms to do it. And then after that, he doesn't want to carry water, so he animates buckets to carry the water. And he doesn't know what he's doing, and he ends up, the place is a complete catastrophe. And except for the story of Icarus, you can't really ask for a better story of what happens when you have a little bit of knowledge and too much technology, and you really, really mess things up. And it's like nobody in this culture knows the story of Icarus and flying too close to the sun. And it's all laid out right there.
And these things, like, aren't going to address climate change.
No.
It's just going to make them worse, maybe.
They don't.
It's a, like you, the title of your book, it's a bright green lie. So if we're really concerned about climate change, which most Americans are now, there's a new study I just saw today, it's by far the number one concern of people 18 to 34, and a majority of Americans now are concerned about it. As I don't want to throw numbers around, but we're becoming more and more concerned right. about this. So,
or we are expressing concern, at least.
I don't think there's anything we can really do. I think it's we're gonna have. I think we're in the midst of exponential change now, and we're only just starting to actually notice it. And I just hope that species like these redwoods can survive that bottleneck.
Well, and what we need to do, that's all the more reason that we need to act, because we need to. There's a couple reasons. One of them is because, as John says, John Osborne says, as things become increasingly chaotic, you know, our actions now, any 1 acre you save, that might be, I mean, it's a crapshoot, and any acre you save might be the acre that has the tree that has the gene to
make it through the bottleneck.
We don't know. And what we do know is if there aren't any rough-skinned newts left, then there aren't any left. And if there is one male and one female left, maybe. And that's what it is for me. That's everything for me. That's part of it. And then the other is, one of my heroes is Henning von Treskow, who was a German general in World War II, who fought, he was part of the resistance against Hitler from fairly early on. And when they asked him after D-Day whether they should all quit, because once D-Day happened, as soon as there was two fronts, the Germans knew, frankly, the German generals knew the war was lost before it started. That's one reason they were arguing against it from the beginning. A lot of the resistance to Hitler from inside Germany was not based on Hitler being, was based on a defense of Germany. They thought this is suicidal. It wasn't based on, well, we actually like the Russians or anything. In any case, once D-Day came, it's all over, and it's just a matter of time. So why would we risk our lives when it's going to be over in a few months anyway? It's a reasonable question. I get this question all the time. It's like, look, civilization's crashing. So just, Derek, just party. Just, you know, play computer games. Just have fun. And Henning von Treskow responded, first off, there are 11,000, I think this number, 11,000 civilians being killed every day. So every day sooner we bring this war to an end is 11,000 civilians. It's the same. There are 200 species being driven extinct every day. And every day sooner that we can bring this monstrosity down is 200 species left to go extinct. And I realize that that's a bit, I realize there's a flywheel. And even if we brought it down today, the 200 species would still go extinct tomorrow. But we would be stopping the ones that were going to go extinct in 5 years or 10 years. We would be stopping those from going extinct. And that's one thing. There's three things I want to say. The next thing is, he also said that one of the reasons they needed to act is because he said, we need to let history know that there were some Germans who did not go along. And I am doing my work for the non-humans, and I am doing my work for the humans in the future. And if there's any humans in the future, as my friend Lear Keith always says, if there's anybody left in 100 years, they're going to wonder what the fuck was wrong with us that we didn't fight like hell when the world was going down. And I'm writing for them. And I want for them to be able to say, yeah, there were some people who tried. There's that. And then also, all of the, you can color me optimistic on this one, which is not something I get accused of very often. But I'm still, all of their projections on how global warming will continue are based on human civilization continuing. All of them. They don't even run the model with what would happen if we reduced emissions to zero tomorrow. And if we allowed trees and everything to come back. One reason for this is because of our, one of the things I've gotten shit for a long time is my utter loyalty to physical reality. That physical reality is always more important than what we think about it. And one of the problems is that in this culture, we value what we think more than we value what is, always. And one example of that is all the solutions to so-called global warming, no, all the so-called solutions, probably put in the wrong place, not so-called global warming, that was a mistake. All the so-called solutions that we have, that we see to global warming, all take industrial capitalism as a given and the natural world is having to conform to it, including all the projections. They all presume that industrial civilization continues. And that is literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because without a living planet, you have no social system whatsoever. It really bugs me when I get accused of being misanthropic, because I don't think there's anything more misanthropic than destroying habitat that is required for humans to survive. I actually kind of like humans, and I think humans should continue on the planet, not in these numbers and not living this way, because it won't last. It's just, and I'm going to come back to something, I want to come back to my main point in a second. I want to make another sort of side point, which is that it's kind of funny, but I come to some of this environmentalism by being fundamentally conservative. And I don't mean that means I hate gays. I'm not conservative in that way. I'm just conservative, just like every conservationist really is. It's just, I think it's monumentally stupid to wipe out runs of salmon that people ate for 12,000 years when tomorrow you might be hungry. I think you can't do anything in the world more stupid than that. And, I mean, yes, salmon deserve to live on their own, but if somebody would have brought down civilization 300 years ago, people in this area could still eat all the salmon they want. You can't do that now. Anyway, what I was going to get to with the other is that, here's the part where I'm optimistic, is that, and I could be wrong, but I think if civilization were brought down tomorrow and forests were allowed to do what forests do, and prairies were allowed to do what prairies do, and salt marshes were allowed to do what salt marshes do, and mangroves were allowed to do what mangroves do, I actually think the world would be okay. I'm not one of those people who says, oh, everything's going to be okay. I hate it when people say that as an excuse not to do anything. Because I'm saying if civilization comes down, which means we need to bring it the fuck down. If space aliens from outer space were doing to the planet what this culture is doing, and we had scientists who were figuring out what's going to happen in the future, you can bet that one of their scenarios would be, what if we're able to stop them? What would the world be able to recover? What I know is that if we don't stop this, the world is dead. If we do stop it, maybe.
We're not going to orderly disband.
I wish we would.
I had an interesting experience, and I don't know why this came to mind, but I was in the Jackson Hole Airport, and there were hundreds of us, and we were all nicely in line, and all of a sudden,
is this the classic bank queue?
Yeah, sort of like everyone run for your.
Yeah, go
money.
Ahead. Go ahead.
The computer shut down, and everyone starts panicking, and then this nice orderly line system of lines quickly broke down, and people just started mobbing the front. And I was about halfway back in the line, and I just stood there. It was a really weird moment, and I just watched everybody congregate in front of me, and this. It's sort of chaotic. I mean, people weren't pushing and shoving, but it was pretty darn close to it. And I just stood there with my bags, and all of a sudden, I'm the last person standing there. And everyone had moved out. And I was just kind of in this, like, really weird stupor, just observing. And one of the attendants came over and said, "Sir, do you have a plane to catch?" I said, "Yeah, I do." So she took my ID, and then she tried to get me to run down the... you know, the jetway and everything, and I wouldn't do it. I just walked onto the airplane, and I caught the flight. But that, there's something about that moment that really stuck with me, and I hadn't thought about this in a year or two, but I don't know if that's a metaphor for the pandemonium and how things would
metaphor
go.
Or something.
I don't know. It was just really fascinating that, like, all of a sudden that order just breaks down, and it's so... it's so fragile, and we're a product of oil. Most of our food comes from oil, and as soon as we can't get to that oil anymore and create our fertilizer, what are we going to eat? We've killed off the salmon. We've killed off the buffalo. How do we farm? I want to be optimistic, but I suppose it just depends on what you want to measure as a success. Like,
the only measure I care about is the health of the planet.
the natural world and how that continues. I just don't see how humans can continue.
Oh yeah, I don't think
in our capacity at all. There might be remnant populations of us left, but
well, and that's one of the things is that when people accuse me of being anti-human, it's like, again, you can't be more anti-human than to convert the world into machines and then be surprised when the machines don't feed you.
Right.
I mean, the machines are the real winners of all this.
And the owners of the machines as we ride off into the sunset.
And have you read Lewis Mumford much?
No.
Okay, Lewis Mumford, I want to bring him in because he's really interesting. I think he's one of the most important philosophers of the 20th century. And he was a pro-technology philosopher until World War II. He'd written several books. And then World War II changed his mind. And it's pretty cool when you see somebody who's willing to publicly admit they were wrong. Mm. So he changed completely and was one of the foremost critics of technology. And one of his big deals was that there are democratic and authoritarian technologies. Well, first off, the technology doesn't arise from nowhere. He called the society, the social system that surrounds and gives rise to a technology, a technic, T-E-C-H-N-I-C. And the social system that arises from a technology is also part of the technic. And so people don't invent, there's a truck driving by, and
when society collapses, they'll be happy to have silence.
Yeah. And people don't, the Talawa did not invent the internal combustion engine, not because they were too stupid. It's not that there's intelligence differences. It's that the social circumstances surrounding it did not give rise to it. For example, one reason that the local Talawa did not invent refrigerators is presumably because if there's so many salmon in the streams, the meat stays fresher alive anyway. I mean, if there's runs of salmon 4 times a year, you can smoke it in between and then also eat, you know, elk, huckleberries, whatever else there is here. So refrigeration was not a... It's not that they were too stupid. It's that there was no reason
to. There's no necessity for it.
And the social system wasn't there to make them think of it. And he breaks... There's a very short essay. You don't have to read all of his stuff. His two-volume Myth of the Machine is fabulous, but if you don't want to read that, there's an essay online either called Authoritarian and Democratic Technics or Democratic and Authoritarian. I always get it mixed up which is first. It's like 6 pages or 10 pages. Read it. It's great. And in there he talks about how some technics are democratic and some are authoritarian. And there's a couple of things going on. One of them is that if your technic arises from and gives rise to democratic power structures, it's a democratic technic. And there are a few examples of this. One of them is that a bow and arrow would be a democratic technic because anybody can make one. You can't control the means of production. You can make a crap one if you don't know how to do it.
Like 3D printers, would this be a good example today where you can share the file and then anyone can build something?
No, because it's based on electricity and also based on plastic, also based on metals.
Okay, continue.
But with a bow and arrow, I'm completely ignorant, but anybody can whittle down a piece of wood to be fairly straight. You can grab... Mm-hmm. You can't control my access to reeds unless we live in Nevada and there's only one little oasis, in which case... But ignoring that...
Sure.
Under most circumstances, you can't control my access to grass. And on the other hand, if you have a gun, say I've got a whole bunch of guns, but you have access to the mine that makes the
bullets.
I basically have a bunch of fancy clubs. Mm-hmm. That's an authoritarian technic. I was doing an interview several years ago. This just cracks me up. The guy was a dedicated Marxist who believes that we can have an industrial society with 100% voluntary exchanges. And the conversation went almost exactly like this fast. I said, okay, great. Do you have cities? He said, yes. I said, great. How do you get around in your cities? He said, buses. I said, great. What's the bus made of? He said, metal. I said, great. Where do you get the metal? He said, mines. I said, great. How do you get people to work in mines? Mines are, you know, just terrible places to work. And they were one of the first forms of slavery because nobody wants to work in a mine. He said, well, you pay them a whole bunch of money. I said, okay, great, I'll give you that. I'll disagree, but I'll give it to you. What about the pollution from the mine? Because every hard rock mine on the planet pollutes river sources. So what about the people who live next to the river? He said, you pay them to move. I said, great. What happens if they refuse? He said, you pay them more. I said, great. What happens if they have lived there for 5,000 years, their ancestors are buried there, and they refuse to leave their ancestors? What do you do then? He said, how many are there? I said, I don't know, 500. He said, well, the million people in the city vote, and they vote to remove the people from next to the river. I said, do you realize what you've just done? You have gone in less than a minute from all exchanges are purely voluntary to democratic empire,
authoritarian,
land theft from indigenous people, mm-hmm. and genocide, all so you can have a bus. Mm-hmm. He didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And my point is, or Mumford's point would be, that mining is an authoritarian technique. It can only exist with authoritarian regimes. Every step of the way, forcing people into the mines, then you have to protect. And first, you have to steal the land from people. Next, you have to force people into the mines. Next, you have to protect the ore. You have to protect the smelter. You have to have guards to protect the metal to keep people from stealing it. Every step of the way, it requires the entire system that we've got. And that's one reason he would call those authoritarian structures, which, by the way, is one of the problems with the whole climate change movement. They're requiring more mining. Oh, for God's sake, Jacobson's plan to put windmills everywhere would require, just for the windmills, the equivalent of constructing 12 Hoover dams every day in terms of concrete, and also would require, I think, 1.5 times all the iron mined on the entire planet in a year for his windmills. Like, that's the plan that's going to save the planet, is more mining? Anyway, but there's another reason that they're authoritarian. The other reason they're authoritarian is because the technologies themselves are in charge. I know that sounds all Twilight Zone-ish, but it's not. Think about it. First off, are cities designed for human beings or for cars? Cars. They're absolutely designed for cars. And people talk all the time about, oh, does the government take better care of human beings or corporations? Corporations. They don't even exist. They're social machines, is what Mumford called them. And so it's taking, those machines are in charge. Corporations are more important than human beings. Everybody, we go along with this. And all this land is taken up for roads, for cars. They're in charge. And now we have global warming. They're talking about global warming could possibly end civilization. That's what they're trying to say, by the way. All those climate change people say explicitly, we're trying to save civilization, not the planet. Who's in charge? Fucking civilization is in charge. Not only that, but they can't even get it to save civilization because they can't mess with the fossil fuel industry. The fossil fuel industry is more important than life on the planet. That's authoritarian. The economic system. They always, you know, we heard this, and you've heard this a bazillion times. We have to balance the needs of the economic system with the environment. It's like, what you're saying is that the environment, that the economic system is against the environment, and what you're saying is actually more important. It's just nuts. So anyway, that's another reason we're not going to have a voluntary transformation, is because we have made ourselves slaves to the system.
Yeah. What do you do? I don't know. Let's assume that we're heading in a direction where civilization is ending. How do we make changes now to make it more comfortable for ourselves and to live out our existence in a more dignified manner?
Well, as always, my primary concern is for the land, and my primary concern is how the land continues in a dignified manner. Having said that, it's pretty funny. I am not a prepper, and the reason I'm smiling is because I have like a year's worth of food.
You're not supposed to tell anybody.
Too bad, too late. The reason I have a year's worth of food is not because of peak oil people been, you know, clamoring for that for a long time, but instead because two of my sisters are Mormons, and they basically talked my mom into it. Me, I'm like, whatever comes is going to come. But
so you inherited a year's supply of food.
Well, I helped my mom. You know, once my mom was on board, I helped her. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, okay, so let's get this. Nah, I don't want those. I do not want a year's worth of, I don't like onions. So it's like, I don't want a year's worth of diced onions. Forget them. But I do like, you know, pineapple. So let's get a year's worth of diced pineapple chunks. Mm-hmm. So it's really funny that I've got a year's worth of that stuff. But it wasn't because of peak oil. It was because my sister, you know, Mormons do that routinely. That's part of, that's a regular thing, is to have a year's worth of food or however much. Anyway, so I think part of the problem is I don't know what that collapse is going to look like. I don't know if, I mean, here's the thing too. It actually is not that much out of character for me to have a year's worth of supply of food, because like I said, I'm fundamentally conservative. And I think, what do we do? I mean, also that question is impossible to answer because everybody's circumstances are different. And if you're living in the middle of New York City, your options are completely different than if you live in Crescent City with a much smaller population. There's a line that's always stuck with me from Joanne Rand's song Koyaanisqatsi about during collapse. There's something about people in cities, people flopping around like rats in a flood. I don't think, and Paul Shepard said this to me. He said the collapse of civilization, maybe it was David Ehrenfeld, one of the two, said the collapse of civilization is not going to be like we see in the old biblical movies where the walls of Jericho fall. Instead, it's a faltering economy that then sputters up and sputters down, sputters up, sputters down. I don't think it's going to be like, I've just been writing about this last
time. It's not an event, per se. It's a series of events that you'd look back on and...
That people will look back on 50 years from now or something. But I don't know. I mean, a lot of people have been telling me about how the collapse is ongoing. And in the United States, you know, I don't really understand. See, there's some things that really confuse me. Like, you know, the stock market's way up. And I understand the stock market and the economy are not tied. But people keep... I hear people comment, or I see people comment, that unemployment has dropped. But I also know when I go downtown in Crescent City, or when I used to tour, or when I would see some cities, there's like empty shops everywhere. And so...
There's something sinister going on with the reporting, because it serves the corporations. And you have people who have dropped out of the workforce. They're no longer counted.
Right, right, right.
And as long as the corporations have people to provide services, then the stock market goes up, and then they can continue with the unemployment rate because it serves their agenda. At least that's my read of it. Because people are struggling out there today.
Well, I understand.
Big time.
Yeah, and that's the experience when I talk to when I talk to I know a lot of people who really are struggling, and I mean, I know that the purpose of the newspapers and everything is to lie. I get that. Mm-hmm. I've understood that for a long time, but I haven't. This would be a lot easier for us to comprehend and for us to talk about if I've just recently been writing about the mass extinction event at the end of the dinosaur age.
Late Permian or
Triassic or whatever.
End Permian, I forget what they call it.
Yeah.
Anyways.
And basically, it's pretty extraordinary, this big rock. Presuming that that's true, right? Presuming that theory's accurate. Basically, a big rock that set 3/4 of the world's forests on fire just in one shot, and it sent tidal waves that went all the way up to Chicago from the Yucatan Peninsula. And admittedly, the ocean went further up, but that doesn't alter the fact that a huge thing that basically transformed everything overnight. And obviously, that's not quite what we're seeing. That we're seeing this sort of, in human terms, slow motion catastrophe, but in
geologic terms, it's like
this
very,
one's really
very
fast,
faster than that one, yeah, because the climate change after the strike is really what sealed the deal of most beings, I understand.
Well, it was a whip effect that it evidently got really, really cold for a few years because of the ash blocking out the sun, and then at the same time, as soon as that was done, as soon as the ash fell, it heated up really, really quickly because of all the CO2 released both in the explosion and the fires.
Now, whatever survived got mercury poisoning.
Why?
I don't know. They found it in fossils.
Huh. Fairly, I didn't know about that part.
Fairly new
interesting
discovery. Yeah, I'll send you the article.
Which is being repeated today.
Yeah, all the mercury locked up in the Arctic is at risk of being released. So,
wow,
could be another part of our story.
So anyway, I think ask me the question again, because now
how do we treat each other?
The reason I gave such a how do we, answer yeah. is because I haven't really been asked that. Most questions I've been asked a bazillion times, so I have an answer I've done a bazillion times. First time I get asked something is usually it's like, give an answer like I just did. I don't know. But now I've got a better answer. So ask me again. You said something about how do we live a dignified life?
Humans, we're struggling right now. There's a collective trauma, and it's palpable. It's tangible, and we may not always be measuring it properly with our indices and our measurements, but we sort of feel it in our bones that like something isn't right, and that there's a cliff ahead, and there's all these converging factors. How do we live with each other, and how do we treat each other going forward in a dignified way that is righteous?
I go back to Henning von Treskow, and if you are under a murderous regime, for me, dignity comes through resistance, whatever form that resistance takes, whether it's the Sophie Scholl and the White Rose Society handing out leaflets, or whether it's Count Klaus von Stauffenberg trying to assassinate Hitler, or whether it's Irena Sendler, I don't remember if it's Sendler or Sendler, smuggling Jewish children out of the Warsaw Ghetto and hiding them in individual homes. And, I mean, I'm going to write a book in a couple years, and this may piss off some of the environmentalists, but I'm going to write a book in a couple years about feeding wildlife, because I feel very, very, very strongly that one should, whenever appropriate, feed wildlife, which includes bears, because non-human natives are refugees in their own land now. And it pisses me off when people get mad at bears for scrounging through garbage. It's like, bring salmon back and I guarantee they won't be in your garbage. And so I think we need to do, I don't care whether it is a native newt, a native warbler, a native bear, a native elephant, a native king cobra, a native alligator, you know, whomever, a native prairie dog, is like, they need your help. And the way to live a dignified life is to live in service. And this is, I mean, all the religious people have known this. And so just choose. And here's the thing, is find what you love and then defend your beloved. And it doesn't matter whether your beloved is, discourse is falling apart in this society. Discourse is just completely falling apart. And defend that if that's what you love. Or, you know, with the collapse of books, long-form thinking is disappearing. And you're helping long-form thinking by doing a long interview. You know, I interview a bunch of people, and so many of them say to me, not so many, but a few of them say to me, you know, this was so nice. I'm so used to being interviewed for TV or radio where I have 30 seconds to describe what is wrong with making so-called child sex dolls. Like, thank you for giving me 45 minutes to do it. So thank you for giving me hour and a half or however long we've taken to talk, because long-form thinking needs to be defended. And bears need to be defended. And, name three of your favorite non-human beings.
Bull trout, actually.
Bull trout need to be, for God's sake, they're in trouble.
Wolverine.
Oh, they're in real trouble.
And...
But make one a non...
Elk.
Okay, well, elk are in trouble in many places. Name a non-animal. I think I said non-human animals, but name a non-animal, like a redwood tree or a fungus or somebody.
See, I want it to be like something I'm not consuming necessarily. I don't consume bull trout, for the record.
But it'd be okay.
I don't consume Wolverine either, so what am I talking about? I don't know. Birds of paradise are so cool.
Okay. The point is, no matter what you love, it's under assault. And the way people can live with dignity is to live in service, which can also be, if you're anthropocentric, I mean, that's okay too. And when I eventually go down, I mean, I'm going to go down fighting. I'm going to go down fighting for what I love and fighting for what I believe in. And
So that's how you live with dignity.
Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's been really fun. Let's do it again sometime.
Please, let's do it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe through your podcasting app. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit wildernesspodcast.com/support. Thanks for listening.